Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The relationship of the United States to Russia and other members of the former Soviet Union was a major issue at the time that this program was recorded in 1995. The Clinton administration claimed that one of its best foreign policy achievements was the way it handled the Russian situation and the disbanding of the former Soviet Union. Dr. C.M. Brown has, for the past 40 years, studied that relationship as a foreign policy analyst, advisor, and author. He is currently a professor of international relations and the former chairman of the Department of Politics at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. In August of 1995, I met with Professor Brown in the studios of Radio Curious and asked him if he agrees with the analysis of the Clinton administration's claims about its foreign policy achievements.
No, I don't. I think that they've mishandled it, and I think it may come back to haunt us and the rest of the world.
Why? What is your analysis of what should have happened? Yeah. What will haunt us?
Well, I think what will haunt us will be if the extreme nationalists take over in Russia after Yeltsin. And I think that there is a chance that that could well happen. And I believe that the Clinton administration policies, following on some mistakes of the Bush administration, have made that prospect more likely. That is, that the extreme nationalists will take over.
Can you be specific as to what those mistakes of Bush were and how Clinton has built on them or followed them?
Yeah. Well, at the end of the Cold War, when the two military blocs were supposed to be disbanded, the Warsaw Pact was disbanded, but NATO was not disbanded. Okay. Now, what Gorbachev was saying is, let's call off the Cold War.
Right. Okay.
And so let's not be military alliances against one another. And he was able to convince his generals and also people within the Soviet Union that the Americans were willing to make a deal to call off the Cold War. Now, of course, the Soviets wanted to do it for reasons of, to a large extent, of internal economic reconstruction. But in order to not have it look like they were surrendering at the end of the Cold War and simply saying, okay, the United States wins, they needed a deal with the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And Bush indicated to them that, yeah, we were ready to call off the Cold War. When it came right down to it, though, there were a couple of key issues that were very important.
Those being
the mutual disbanding of the military alliances and also how Germany would be treated.
Okay. So those military alliances were the Warsaw Pact.
Warsaw Pact and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization,
okay.
NATO.
Maybe we could talk about those for just a minute for some of our listeners who are not clear what the Warsaw Pact was and what NATO is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Warsaw Pact was the reaction to the formation of NATO in the late 1940s by the United States. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization was formed by the United States as an alliance with its Western European allies to threaten the Soviet Union that if there was ever an attack beyond what had been agreed to as the post-World War II settlement, the Soviets were the dominant power in Eastern Europe, the United States and its allies were dominant in Western Europe, Germany was divided right down the middle. It was ever a breach of that basic division that the United States and its North Atlantic allies would go to war against Russia. Mm-hmm. And they built up a hefty military capability to make that threat credible. The Soviets built, in reaction, what they called the Warsaw Pact, which indicated to the United States and the NATO allies, if you ever use your strength to attempt to change things and to go into the Eastern European area, which is our sphere of dominance, that we will fight you for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And also, if we ever get into a war, it's going to be a big war. You can't push us around. So you have the Cold War in Europe as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, heftily armed, supported by the United States, with the United States there with its with its thousands and thousands of troops, and the Soviet Union supporting the Warsaw Pact countries, and it being there with its thousands and thousands of troops, okay, actually hundreds of thousands of troops on both sides. That's what the Cold War looked like in its most brutal, visible form in Eastern and Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The end of the Cold War, Gorbachev said, okay, if we're serious about ending the Cold War, we have to disband these very provocative military alliances, armed to the teeth, facing each other right in the center of Europe. And we will start disbanding ours, which they did.
The Warsaw Pact.
The Warsaw Pact.
Which Gorbachev led.
Yeah, that's right. We will start doing this. Of course, we expect the United States is going to disband the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
But it didn't.
It did not. It kept, not only did it keep NATO, but it brought the reunited Germany into NATO against the protest of Gorbachev that this was intolerable. Now, why was it intolerable to Gorbachev? He didn't really believe that the United States was going to use this as an aggressive alliance against the Soviets. But within Russia, within the Soviet Union, this was used against Gorbachev as, look, they've humiliated you. They've tricked you into disbanding your military alliance, and they've kept theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this was one of the things that undid Gorbachev. Yeah. And the Bush administration, in keeping NATO alive that way, it was responsible for the rise of extreme anti-Gorbachev nationalism within the Soviet Union, and then after Gorbachev, within Russia, after the Soviet Union broke up.
In the fall of 1991.
Yeah, that's right. And this is still now perpetuated as a major problem. Well, Clinton inherited this. And Clinton now takes it even one step farther.
He pursues Bush's policy.
Bush's policy, but he pursues it even one step farther. The ex-Soviet satellite countries in Eastern Europe, seeing that NATO is now still alive and being favored by the United States as a vehicle for giving support to various countries, wants into NATO. Now, they of course have historic reasons as to why they would like the protection of NATO against Russia.
And we're talking about Hungary and Poland
and Czechoslovakia.
And Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, in particular, as well as Romania and Bulgaria and so on. But particularly the leading countries in this desire to become part of NATO were Czechoslovakia and Poland. We want to become part of NATO, too. And the Clinton administration responds to this by saying, okay, we'll see if we can help you become part of NATO. Okay, and they do it through something called the Partnership for Peace. It's called the Partnership for Peace.
And this is a creation of Clinton.
Of Clinton's administration. You're not really going to become part of NATO yet, but we will conduct all kinds of exercises with you to prepare you to become ready to become part of NATO. Well, Yeltsin now, as head of the Soviet Union, cries foul. He says, NATO, which used to include all the countries of Western Europe and half of Germany, now not only includes all of Germany, but is going to include also the nations of the former Warsaw Pact. They're going to be a part of an anti-Russian alliance against us. Mm-hmm. I'm characterizing it here for you, not necessarily how it really would be used, but how it is perceived by the Russians.
Right.
Okay. They perceive this as a very hostile move. And it's bringing the anti-Russian alliance right up to the borders of Russia.
Which their perception is their reality.
Yeah, that's right. And that perception then becomes reality. Now, Yeltsin is saying, don't do this to me. And he's actually saying, don't do this to me. I don't think you're going to attack us. But this is going to undermine me at home with these extreme nationalists, with Zhirinovsky and others, who are claiming that Gorbachev and now I have sold out Russia. We've allowed ourselves to be humiliated by the United States and the West.
The I being Yeltsin.
Yeltsin, right, yeah. So Clinton now is not pursuing a policy which is going to help develop political stability in Russia, but by this problem, by this policy called the Partnership for Peace, is really a larger NATO, mm-hmm. much farther east than before, is undermining long-term political stability in Russia. That's why I say I don't think that the Russian policy has been all that successful.
So what should the U.S. have done, or what can the United States do now yeah. on this issue?
Well, it still is, I think, reversible. It would be very difficult for Clinton to reverse it. But I really think that what should have been done and what still ought to be done is for the American political leadership, whoever the president is, to say the end of the Cold War means the end of hostile military alliances. This ought to be a post-alliance world. We have a lot of problems. There's the ethnic conflict in Bosnia and Yugoslavia. There are all kinds of nationality conflicts that will be developing in Eastern Europe and in Russia. But for this, we need conflict resolution techniques. And NATO, which is an anti-Russian alliance historically, is not the proper vehicle for this. We don't need to rattle our swords at each other. We need to develop conflict resolution mechanisms and techniques, etc. That's one thing. Another is that Russia ought to be brought more into the family of nations, and they need a lot of economic help for doing so. There again, the United States has taken a position of perhaps asking Russia to concede to things more rapidly than Russia really can. Certain demands by the International Monetary Fund that they privatize very rapidly as a condition for getting various kinds of economic help. And this, I think, has increased the problems for the Yeltsin regime, rather than allowing the Yeltsin regime to develop an indigenous Russian capability to make the transition from state socialism to a market economy in a way that's more consistent with Russian traditions.
Where do you see this going with Yeltsin's health sometimes being put in question and the ultra-nationalists waiting in the wings? How do you see this balance?
I'm pessimistic. I'm very pessimistic as to what's going to happen come 1996 when the elections are supposed to be held in Russia. And I think most serious observers are. All bets are off. And it could be that the nationalists really develop a controlling and dominant voice in how to run Russia.
Through the electoral process in Russia or through a coup?
They think they can do it through the electoral process. I'm not convinced that if the electoral process, by some almost miracle at this point, sustains the Yeltsin forces or people who are legitimate successors to Yeltsin, not the crazies, and they really are, some of them.
Well, describe that. When you yeah. call them crazies, that's a pretty serious characterization.
Yeah. Well, Zhirinovsky, for example, who is a leader of the ultra-nationalist factions, has indicated that he thinks that it was wrong for Russia to give up, for the Soviet Union to give up all of its Western areas, Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania, for example, even them, and thinks they ought to be reabsorbed into a greater Soviet Union. That what Gorbachev and Yeltsin did to take apart the Soviet Union ought to be reversed, and if other countries don't like it, that Russia still has an important a hefty nuclear capability, and there's no reason why it shouldn't use that nuclear capability to provide for its own security. He said things as extreme as this. Mm-hmm. He's even said things that sound that really sound crazy, and people ask whether he is a clown or whether he's serious. I remind you that that was what's asked about Hitler mm-hmm. in the 1930s. But he has even said that the United States should, if it's necessary, that Russia should, if it's necessary, take back Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Let me take a moment and tell our listeners that you're listening to Radio Curious, and my guest this week is Professor C.M. Brown, who teaches international relations at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, and we're talking about his analysis of the United States foreign policy as it affects Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and the ex-Soviet Union. And my name is Barry Vogel. What would you say are the motives of the ultra-nationalists in Russia to do what they're doing?
They see what has happened since the end of the Cold War, and this disbanding of the Soviet state. They see this as contributing to chaos and anarchy within the ex-Soviet Union. And they feel that one of the contributions, although a lot of them didn't like the communist system, they feel that at least one of the contributions of the communist system was that they forged a national unity, which was necessary to keep this very diverse, ethnically polyglot empire whole. And so they feel, I think, Zhirinovsky and others feel, that we have to create again an excitement around the power and the grandeur of Russia, and particularly of the larger Russia, which was the Soviet Union, but of the Russian Empire. And things like what was going on in Chechnya, for example, they are for absolutely no compromise with the Chechnyans.
In other words, yeah. The Chechnyans conform and be part of of Russia.
Yeah, they say, you know, the Ukrainians are thumbing their nose at the Russians on a whole lot of history. Issues. We shouldn't put up with this. Ukraine is a second-rate power. The Soviet, ex-Soviet Union, Russia is a superpower. Why are we allowing all of these small pipsqueak nations on our borders to push us around? And they're doing this in the name of restoring the pride of the larger nation.
Yet, doesn't that deny the ethnicity or the ethnic background of Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Ukraine, the Chechnyans?
It certainly does. But like the old empires... ancient empires, including the Roman Empire, the imperialists feel that they have a grander mission to subordinate these various groups into a larger imperial realm.
So, in other words, their motive would be for their personal leadership under their ideas?
Well, I think you could say that that's the road that they have chosen to achieve personal leadership, if you want to make it a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think in their own minds, they probably are convinced that they are the heroes of a revived Greater Russia.
As was Hitler.
As was Hitler, probably in his mind, convinced that he was the hero of a revived Greater Reich.
And perhaps as was the leadership of the United States during the creation of the Manifest Destiny 150 years ago.
It's something that is manifest in many countries as their destiny.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, then, taking it from the perspective of the United States, what would you characterize as the motives of the United States, whether it would be Bush or Clinton, to not disband NATO and create this problem that you described?
For Bush, I think it was he was riding high at the end of the Cold War and at the end of the Gulf War, and really was like the cat that had swallowed the canary. And he wanted to turn the Cold War into a victory for the United States, as Reagan certainly would have. He wanted to show that the Cold War was won by the United States. It wasn't simply over. So what he did, he was very tempted to do it, and he actually did it. He made the former adversary eat humble pie, and he gloated over it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, with Clinton, I think it's inertia, which is part of the problem of Clinton. Something was set in motion before he came into office. They were going to keep NATO, and now new things are happening in which the East Europeans, even distinguished people like Walesa and Havel, are asking to be part of NATO. Without having any vision himself, he's responding to these demands in a kind of inertia and saying, well, okay, you want to be part of NATO, I guess it's too early to bring you in, but let's say eventually you can come in.
Mm-hmm. Have your probationary period in the Partnership for Peace.
Yeah, right. So I think it's that. It's the typical lack of Clinton vision in the foreign policy field, coupled with this inertia and confusion.
So are you saying then that there are no real motives or no goals compared to those that you describe in the ultra-conservative leadership in Russia?
I think that's correct. I think it's a lack of, on the one hand, a lack of clear goals in leadership. Again, I don't want to draw the parallels too much, but if between World War I and World War II, it was the lack of any concept of what was really required to bring some kind of an order out of the terrible depression that the world had faced internationally, lack of any real leadership at that time, that allowed the Hitlers and the Mussolinis to thumb their nose at the United Nations and at the Western democracies and do what they wanted. Then we had the terrible multidimensional Holocaust of World War II.
Well, Dr. Brown, you're indicating that Clinton and his predecessors have failed in dealing with Russia. How about the dealing with the other major adversary of China? Mm-hmm. What's your analysis of that relationship?
Yeah. Rather than saying there's been a failure in dealing with that relationship in a fundamental way, I think that there is yet a lot of adaptation that's going to have to be made to the new China. What I mean by the new China is the China that is emerging as eventually not only the most populous country in Asia, but the biggest military power. And probably economists looking at China say that probably by the middle of the next century, the economic superpower of Asia, even eclipsing Japan. Okay. Now, the United States is running into more and more difficulties with China. Some things get the headline, like this Harry Wu, ex-Chinese himself, who goes back and exposes the prison conditions and so on.
Right.
The Tiananmen Square business back in 1989 and its legacy in the present, and that is obviously a bad human rights situation, not only those things displayed by Harry Wu. Okay, so those things are there as a problem. In the meantime, China is emerging as an economic giant and as a military giant. And so the United States is in this position here of trying to develop a new relationship with China and not being sure exactly how it should do so. This presents itself, again, unfortunately for the Clinton administration, this presents itself in the form of a number of flip-flops by the Clinton administration.
Those flip-flops being?
Yeah. Well, the biggest one, of course, was Clinton's reneging on his policy with respect to human rights in China. And as you remember, Clinton castigated the Bush administration for pursuing a normal commercial relationship with China, China having what's called most favored nations trading privileges.
Right.
Even though China, the regime in Beijing, was now being exposed as having a terrible human rights record. And so the Clinton administration comes into power after promising the electorate that we are not going to let the Chinese off of the hook, and unless they show a fundamental reform in the way they are conducting their own political arrangements, particularly those that that have human rights dimensions, then unless they improve very substantially the human rights dimensions, we will take away their normal trading privileges. And this was something that was indicated during the campaign, and it's also, as Clinton comes into office, this is going to be one of his major foreign policy projects.
Which he has not yet brought about.
Not only that, he has explicitly renounced it. He said in 1994 that he's now delinking, they are delinking human rights from commercial relationships with China. Okay. Mm-hmm. So before the American people and before the world, Clinton looks like commerce is leading morality. I mean, there's no morality anymore, although Clinton is criticizing the Bush administration for being totally amoral with respect to the Chinese human rights situation. Now, it's an independent question as to whether or not Clinton should have put the human rights situation ahead of the larger commercial interests, okay, that the United States perhaps has an important reason to build with China. The question as to what was the right policy or the wrong policy, we can get into. What I'm trying to suggest to you here, though, that this is part of the larger Clinton problem of saying one thing at one time and then reversing himself and looking like he's inconstant and doesn't know his own mind. Okay, so China very much fits into that category. And if you want to ask my views on the merits...
Well, what are they? That's the next question.
Yeah. Okay, I am not in favor, personally, as an analyst and as a sometimes policy advisor, I'm not in favor of linking commercial relationships, okay, that closely to the human rights conditions in China or in other countries.
And now aren't we talking about the allegations that many of the products and the merchandise that's made in China is made under prison or slave labor conditions?
Yes.
That are sold here and yes. for many dollars?
Yes, right. Now, the question is what you do about that. Okay.
And what is done about it?
Now, you may want to say that to the extent that we can document that certain products that are sold here are produced by slave labor, you may want to target those products and say they're inadmissible in the American market. Okay. Now, this is different than saying we're going to clamp a 10% tariff or whatever it is on everything that comes in from China. We're going to treat China differently than we treat other nations. We're not going to allow them normal trading relationships. Okay. And also, one effective way of dealing with these kinds of situations is to allow private Americans, stimulated by a lot of private interest groups, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on, to privately boycott these products. Okay. Mm-hmm. Have consumers do this because they're offended by the fact that they're produced by Chinese labor. I think you can conduct that kind of policy, but I don't think that it is wise for the United States over the long run to cut itself off from major commercial relationship with China. Other countries will jump in. China is not going to be sent, a begging.
Well, Dr. C.M. Brown, we're coming to the end of our time, unfortunately, mm-hmm. because I can see there's a lot more to talk about here and the balances of connecting commercial interests with human rights and so forth. But unfortunately, we are running out of time. And I do want to ask you the question, as you know, that I like to ask at the end of all of my interviews. And is there a particular book or reference that is of interest to you that you've read or could direct our readers to on this or other topics?
Mm-hmm. Well, I frequently am reluctant to blow my own horn, but I really feel that the best book I've read recently on the topics we've just been talking about is a book that I authored called New Forces, Old Forces, and the Future of World Politics, published by HarperCollins in 1995.
Well, Dr. C.M. Brown, thank you very much for joining us here on Radio Curious.
You're very welcome, Barry. It's a pleasure to be here.
In this archive edition of Radio Curious, our guest was Professor C.M. Brown from Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. The book he recommends is one that he authored, New Forces, Old Forces, and the Future of World Politics by C.M. Brown. The first name is spelled S-E-Y-O-M. The second name is Brown, like the color. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.